Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, today we're diving into a few of the stories in John DeLeo's fascinating new book. I say diving into a few of the stories because this is one of those books, I'm warning you, that you pick up for 5 minutes. You think, I'll just read this chapter real quick, or I'll just read about this particular character. And before you know it, that 5 minutes has turned into 2 hours, and in some cases, 3 hours. Trust me, I've been there. The book is called There Are No Small Parts, 100 Outstanding Film Performances with Screen Time of 10 Minutes or Less. And that means we're going to the movies today, vicariously at least. In the book, There Are No Small Parts, John features 100 outstanding film performances, as the title implies, worthy actors, some of them very big names and at the peak of their career, had just 10 minutes or less screen time. From Gene Hackman and Al Pacino to some of the old greats, starting with the original Bride of Frankenstein, Elsa Lanchester. Let me tell you a little about my guest. John DeLeo is the author of 6 previous books about classic movies. He's been a frequent participant in the Black Bear Film Festival. He's conducted onstage interviews with many named actors and is often heard on Sirius XM Radio. As a book reviewer, he's contributed frequently to the Washington Post. And again, the name of the book is called There Are No Small Parts, 100 Outstanding Film Performances with Screen Time of 10 Minutes or Less. And here's my guest, John DeLeo. John DeLeo, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vicki. It's so good to be with you.
All I could think of when I was looking at your book was my mother would love this because she's such a movie buff. And you've done such a great job of putting this together. I want to just begin with the fact that you call yourself an art historian and you have this incredible, I don't know if it's in a basement, but thanks to the artist market on YouTube, I got to take a virtual tour of your fabulous collection. Every wall, every nook, every cranny is filled with posters, photos, books, and even a Mary Poppins spoon. So tell us how all this began for you.
Well, I don't come from a show business family at all, but I did come from a family that loved the movies. So when I was a little kid in the 60s and 70s, there was always an old movie on the television somewhere. And one of my family members, whether a parent or a grandparent, watching it intensely, and I would get intrigued and sit down, and I found that I was looking to see what was going to be on, and I became a fan. And originally, I thought that meant I wanted to be a performer, and it did actually mean that for a while. But as I sort of approached my early 30s, and I had done quite a bit of stage work, but hadn't really gotten too far in terms of being what you'd call a success or making a living or feeling like I had found my place, I kind of went through a period of transition and thought, well, I've got this love of film. Maybe I could do something with it. And that was the impetus for my first book, which came out in 1999. That's my quiz book. So that was kind of a sort of dipping the toes in the water where I wasn't really sure about my ability as a film historian or as a critic, but I thought I could be clever for a couple of, maybe 200 pages of quizzes. And then from there, the fact that it got published and did pretty well, it gave me the confidence to share more of what I felt about the movies. And I think I felt basically that I had a lot of things I wanted to say and that I had to get better and better as a writer with each book so I could express it, the best I possibly could. As for the basement, I say to people when they see it, it's sort of like welcome to the inside of my head, because it's sort of like all the things swirling around up on the walls of this basement that I've been collecting since I was a teenager. But you mentioned the Mary Poppins spoon. I got that when I was 3. That's the oldest thing in terms of in my possession. There are things that are many years older, from the 30s and 40s that I acquired, as nostalgia. But yeah, it's nice to have everything up there and looking at it instead of having it boxed and hidden away.
Right. And when I say basement, I mean, we're talking this beautifully laid out. I could imagine myself spending days in there and not wanting to come out.
Yes, people have said that. It's been called my cave, my lair, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. So I understand you're interested in movies, but since you were a stage actor for so long, why movies and not stage? Why did you choose to write about movies and get more into that?
Well, I guess my love of the stage came from my love of film, because I don't remember going to see too many plays until I was a teenager. So my sort of way into the world of performance was the people I loved in the movies. And so I got to express that, like, in junior high and high school on a stage, and then in college and that. So I think I was more, when I was performing, it was always about the audience and singing and dancing and working together as a team backstage and all that stuff that we've seen in hundreds of movies, of course, that I loved so much. But my real passion in terms of what I wanted to write about was film and film history. Although one of my books is about the Tennessee Williams films, and that one is just as much a theater book as a film book, because all of the, you know, the original material, just right, about all of it, is based on his plays. So that was very important to what the book was about. And I guess, you know what it is too, a lot of what I write about in my film books is acting, and so my background in acting, I think, gave me the confidence to write so much about what actors do, whether it's film or theater, what actors do, what's on the page, what I suspect came from the director, what I suspect it came from the adaptation from a book or a play, and what I perceive as coming directly from the actor's interpretation of what was on the page. And that's always fun to sort of conjecture, make your own guesses about what's going on and how they you know, bring such an impact to the material, whether it's good or bad material. It's still, what do they bring to it?
Right. That's one of the things that Actors Workshop was, I think, that TV series with James Lipton was so successful. Was it the Actors Studio, I think?
Yeah,
I think, because understanding what goes into it all I find fascinating. You know, even though I've never been an actor, as a writer, I found it fascinating. This is your seventh book. There are no small parts as your seventh book. What inspired the idea for this particular book?
Well, as I said, I've written, there was a book, the second book was 100 Great Film Performances You Should Remember But Probably Don't, and it was similar in format, but I dealt with 100 great performances, but in that case, they were star performances that had been overlooked, and like I said, in the Tennessee Williams book, I was dealing with some of the greatest roles ever written, and at some point, I realized there was a type of performance that you could hardly ever talk about because it was too small. In most cases, even too small to be nominated for a supporting Oscar, although two of the people in this book won for the performances that I write about. But generally, if you're in a movie for 3 minutes or 5 minutes, or even up to the, you know, 10-minute mark, it's hard to get that kind of attention, aside from, oh yeah, that was a nice scene that somebody had, but they often people don't know the actor's name, and they just remember the character or the scene. And I thought it would be fun to do it because I could span the decades. I start in the 30s, go up to the present. I could deal with famous people doing cameos. I could deal with character actors where people never learn their names, or people making their film debut, or, you know, people like Marilyn Monroe on the rise. And so it was a really nice variety within the constraints of roles under 10 minutes long. And so, it was great fun because of the variety of types of movies and types of actors. And so every time I started a new essay, it was a completely fresh experience for me.
Right. So I wanted to begin with one of my favorite characters as a kid, because I didn't see this, obviously it'd been out for a while, but I remember seeing this as a kid, and that was Gone with the Wind, and Hattie McDaniel played Mammy, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that was just her name, Mammy, yeah, in that. But you have in the book, she's in a film that even though she's won Oscars after that, she didn't have a great deal of luck after that film. In fact, you say unless Olivia de Havilland was in the room, she didn't really get any meaty parts. So tell us about her, because I love that character as a child.
Yeah, and of course her mammy is famous for being the first time an African American performer won an acting Oscar, and there wouldn't be another one until 1963 with Sidney Poitier. So there's this long sort of period where there were other nominations for other African Americans, but nobody had won. But of course, the sad thing about her win is that it doesn't lead to anything. Mm. It's just a one shot kind of thing. We acknowledge you were wonderful, but there's really nowhere for you to go in the climate of the country, of the industry, and so there are no really good parts for her. She kind of the difference is now everyone in the audience going to the movies knows who she is because they all saw Gone with the Wind, and they would be sitting there thinking, oh, there's Mammy, doing essentially a lesser version of what she had done so brilliantly in Gone with the Wind, because it's a real emotional role. She has a stunning scene on the staircase telling Olivia de Havilland about the horrible fighting between Scarlett and Rhett that's been going on, and she's sobbing through much of it, and it's beautiful. So the movie in my book that I write about is sort of the one role that I can detect where she got a little of the respect she deserved, even though the role is only 2.5 minutes long. And the movie is In This Our Life from 1942. So that's 3 years after Gone with the Wind. She's an Academy Award winner. She's again acting in this beautiful scene with Olivia de Havilland. Bette Davis is also in the movie. And she is playing a servant, and she has a couple of short scenes being a servant. But the one scene that really sort of clinched it for me is that she's confiding in her employer, Olivia de Havilland, that her son has been wrongfully arrested for a hit and run that was actually done by Bette Davis, who is Olivia's evil sister. And she's just a mother in the scene. She's a worried mother opening up to a sympathetic friend. And it's played with such dignity and simplicity and beauty, and therefore it's so moving. And again, it's a reminder of all the potential she had, even though she won an Oscar. So much of that potential that she had would be untapped because there just weren't opportunities for her. So it was fun for me in the book to at least shine a light on someone that, again, I keep saying it, even though she's an Academy Award winner, really never got what she could have gotten based on her actual talent.
Right. And, getting to play with Bette Davis and Olivia de Havilland, great. I mean, it shows that she had the talent to be there in the first place.
Yeah.
By the way, before I forget, I want to say I love that you attached a bookmark to the book.
Thank you. Well, because my publisher will be thrilled.
Well, because it's the kind of book that you want to just, leave on your coffee table and pick it up randomly. And, I love that it had a bookmark in there.
So she will be delighted. Thank you.
Obviously, that was her idea then, right?
Yes.
Tell me, as you're thinking about, you've got all this great knowledge in your head and all this excitement and passion for movies and actors. Did you set out with a specific criteria in that they must meet this criteria to be in the book, other than they were on screen for under 10 minutes?
I think the answer is no. That was really the only thing that was essential. I decided to start in 1935, and that was sort of a random choice. I could have started a little earlier, but I thought I really wanted to start the book with a bang and with a famous movie and a famous performance. And the first one I thought of that would fit that was Elsa Lanchester as Bride of Frankenstein in Bride of Frankenstein, because I thought even the most casual reader would see the first page and think, oh, well, I know that. So it would be a way in. And I think the only other thing that I was conscious of when I was kind of finishing up, the book is arranged chronologically, as you know, and as I was nearing, doing the last 10 or so, I wanted to make sure it was smooth chronologically, and I didn't want there to be too many years in a row where there was no one.
Right.
I was a little conscious of filling in some of the gaps. Like, I need a performance from this period, and so I maybe was a little more calculating toward the very end. But generally, aside from the time constraints, anybody could be in it. And I did limit myself to English language performances only because there are it was already, you know, hundreds and hundreds to choose from. I was just trying to make it a little easier on myself.
Yeah, yeah. So let's jump to another Frankenstein movie, 1974, Gene Hackman in Young Frankenstein. I love Gene Hackman. Another great actor.
Well, this was a case of, you have, at this point, a very famous star making a cameo, and an unbilled cameo, so that the audience would get the fun of saying, is that Gene Hackman? Oh my God, it's Gene Hackman. Or some people never figuring it out until the movie was over. Yes, this is a delightful spoof of the blind man scene from the original Bride of Frankenstein. And it's particularly wonderful because at that point in 1974, Gene Hackman was at the top of his career in a series of very serious roles, winning the Oscar for The French Connection. He was in Scarecrow and I Never Sang for My Father and the great film The Conversation. So the joy of seeing this super serious movie actor play this four-minute hilarious scene with a kind of genius deadpan flair. He must have had a ball. We have a ball, especially knowing it's that kind of guy and not the usual person who shows up in a Mel Brooks movie. And so, I mean, I love the movie all the way through, but that is a particular highlight.
Right, right. I want to jump to Agnes Moorehead because, number one, she used to terrify me as a kid. She reminded me of my grandmother, who somewhat terrified me at times. She kind of looked like her, and she had those eyes and red hair. But I did not know that she didn't hit the movies until she was in her 40s.
Yeah, she... stage, but radio, and really she's part of that Orson Welles group of people who kind of arrived on the scene with him and Citizen Kane, and then she does The Magnificent Ambersons. So in those first few years of her movie career, she is part of the, you know, Orson Welles Mercury Players, but then she's so good in what she's in, then she's at MGM for many years, and then she's in so many movies, and then of course has her television immortality as Andora on Bewitched in the 60s, but it's a really fantastic movie career, and she got to play all kinds of things, funny parts, and as you said, scary parts, you know, crazy villains, elegant ladies, the slatternly servant in Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte. In my book, she plays a queen in the movie The Swan from 1956 with Grace Kelly and Alec Guinness, and she's only in the last few minutes. She sort of swoops in and tries to solve everything at the last minute, and it's a comic role, and she's very grand and has people, you know, running up and down to satisfy every whim of hers, and she's just delicious and delightful, and it's a charming movie, and she's sort of like the cherry on top in the last few minutes.
Right, right. You kind of hit on this, but when I first saw the book, I assumed that these were all character actors or people who are famous now but were first starting up. And you had people in the book in the peak of their careers just making very short appearances. One of the ones that I liked, and she was kind of probably just starting out at this time, but Jane Alexander is one of my favorite actors. And she was in The President's Men. She didn't even have a name. She didn't even have a character name in that. She was just the bookkeeper. Why did you choose to put her in there?
Well, you know, Jane Alexander, I guess she was one of the inspirations for the book because I've been fortunate enough, I have the Black Bear Film Festival here in Milford, Pennsylvania, where I am, and one of the people that was one of our honored guests was Jane Alexander. This was in 2018, and so I got to interview her on the stage for, you know, a sellout crowd, and she was everything you'd ever want her to be, and the kindest, just wonderful. I was crazy about her, and we really hit it off, and I'd say we became sort of friends, and we kept up, and I went to see her in New York when she was in a play and all, and I had this idea for the book, and I wrote to her, and I said, I'm doing this book, this is the idea, and it looks like you're going to be in it because you're such an obvious choice for what you did in All the President's Men, which she had told me personally she thought was the best film of acting she ever did on film in her whole career. Mm-hmm. So she was extremely proud of it, and she was nominated for an Oscar for it. And she was delighted when I told her, and then when it was done, I said, look, I'm done. If I send it to you, would you consider giving us a quote, if you like it and all? And she said, I'd be happy to do that. And she was good on her word. She read the whole thing, gave me a beautiful quote that you can see. It's on the back of the book. And she typifies, again, what the book is about. You're right, she was a star. The role was so good, she wanted to do it, even if it is 8.5 minutes long, and it's memorable, and it's a really lesson in screen acting, because so much of it is not in the words, but it's in the expressions in between the words, what she's holding back, what she's afraid to say, and it's beautiful, it's economical, and like I said, as short as it is, she deserved her Oscar nomination. So even though she's sort of a star and a character actor in terms of the way we might think of her, that's a great role for her in sort of her character actor mode, because she's not the leading lady. Well, there is no leading lady in that movie, but right. But she's there really as a character actor.
Right. Well, there's that quote that's in the front of your book by, I think it was a famous coach who said, there are no small parts, only small actors.
Yes. Stanislavski's quote. The book, it does speak to that, in that look what these 100 people did with less than 10 minutes, enough for me to write 3 pages on each one of them. So, yeah.
Right, right. Well, Jane Alexander, in that quote on the back of the book, she says, I confess to having never been so thoroughly dissected in a part. And she also says, I want to just, many of the movies, 100 movies are well known, others obscure, but DeLeo makes you want to see them all and revisit the under 10 minute performances. And I have to agree with that, because I'm like, okay, I got to start looking at some of these old movies again, because I've seen a lot of them because my mum was such a buff, but it'd be so fun to go back and revisit. Let's talk about Philip Seymour Hoffman. What a great loss he was, I feel, to the acting world. And he was in the talented Mr. I don't even remember him being in the talented Mr. Ripley, to be honest, but he was in there for a whole 9 minutes in 1999. So talk to us about him.
Yeah, he was one of those people, in the 90s, we kept seeing him, and he was often very different. Talk about a real chameleon kind of character actor.
Yeah.
He was in, I think the first time I ever noticed him was in Scent of a Woman, but then he was prominent in Boogie Nights, and then Challenged Mr. Ripley, Cold Mountain, I'm thinking of others, but he was someone who clearly got where he got purely on the fact that he was so darn good at playing pretty much anything. And his role in Talented Mr. Ripley, he isn't in it for long, but he is, you should see it again. It is essential, and he's kind of a rich, snobby, wise guy kid who starts to figure out that Matt Damon may not be who he says he is. And he's even when he's playing kind of someone you don't really want to like, he's such a great actor that you're so tuned into anything he's doing that you kind of like him because you love watching him. He's so commanding, and he's terrific in it. And you're right, it is a serious loss. Of course, by 2005 with Capote, then everyone knew his name and everyone was acknowledging his gifts. He was only in his mid-40s when he died, so there were decades more of great performances to come, of course.
Yeah, I remember when I saw Capote on Netflix, actually, and I don't remember when it came out, but did you say 2005, somewhere around there?
Yeah.
But I could not imagine Philip Seymour Hoffman playing him until I saw him, and I was like, oh my God, he's a chameleon, as you said.
Yeah.
He's a sign of a good actor.
And of course, when you're really great at something like that, it's not just the impersonation where you got the voice, got the look, got the movement, but you feel like it's coming from the gut as well. So So it's a complete possession, physical and emotional.
Yeah. Do you have, of all the people you featured, do you have a couple of favorites yourself?
In the book, well, like I've been saying that I love all 100 of them, because to spend the amount of time I spent with them, I would have to love them.
Right,
and, you know,
right.
To be tuned into every nuance of everything I felt that they were doing. I mean, I did love writing about some of the lesser-known character actors because, like I said, it made me happy to shine a little light on someone in 2022 still talking about an actor who, say, died in 1939, that kind of thing. So that pleased me. But I love like writing about the great Thelma Ritter and her screen debut in Miracle on 34th Street. Another film debut, Robert Duvall in To Kill a Mockingbird. More recently, Jane Lynch as Meryl Streep's sister in Julie and Julia. It really was fun to span the decades and think, you know, I didn't write them in the order in which they appear, so it would be fun to, you know, write about Gene Wilder in Bonnie and Clyde in the 60s and then jump back to the 40s and write about Judith Anderson and Laura. Or I'm writing about a serious movie, I want to write about a comedy next. And so that whole process, of course, was very pleasurable.
Right.
And I didn't ever have to worry about writer's block, because if it was something I didn't want to write about, I'd say, no, I'm not going to do that one, onto the something else, and then just go on. So, yeah, I was able to really keep him going at a steady pace.
Yeah. So I heard you say that you didn't begin with the first one. You did that somewhere in the middle, but you always want to end with the end story.
I don't like to, like you said, my books, you can just dip into them, because it's not like reading a novel where you have to remember what happened. You can read about somebody and then go back and read about another actor or another movie. Sometimes I feel like it takes me, in this case, it was 100 performances, so after about 25, say, I really feel like I'm really in my groove. So I probably wrote that first one about Elsa Lanchester as Bride of Frankenstein somewhere like the 30th or 35th one, where I really felt I was cooking. But I always like to write the last one last, because I always feel like it's some kind of summation of the whole thing, and I really want to end it with that feeling of this is coming to a close. So that's the way I've sort of operated, and it always sort of feels right, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
So this being your 7th book, how did writing this book help you grow as a writer, and what did you learn from writing this that you'll take forward with you?
I think the thing that I felt like I've been learning for the last, you know, 25 years of doing this is the skill of making the reader read your sentences the way you intended them to be read, making sure, if you want to be funny, that you set it in the way that it's most obvious that it is funny, you know?
Right.
So I think I've gotten very good at being able to guide the reader to read it as if I were speaking to you, even if you don't know me or don't know what I sound like or what my inflections would be. I hope as a writer I'm guiding you to read every sentence the way in which, you know, each one was intended. So I think I've gotten pretty good at that, and being more economical, knowing what to cut away. You've already kind of said that, you don't have to say it again. And I think it goes back to also my actor training. When you're in a play and you're in a role, you're always trying to connect every thought. So if I say something, the next thing I'm going to say has to mentally connect to what I just said. And I do try to do that as a writer, that every sentence is the logical next sentence. So these are just things that I'm always aware of, and I think I've sort of gotten, you know, better and better at that with each one. And so, you know, of course you read these things hundreds of times when books get published, and you think you have so many chances to do all the things I just said, and you just hope that you kind of got pretty close to what you hoped it would be.
Well, you end the book, you end There Are No Small Parts, appropriately enough, with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That was about Al Pacino. I think he's my all-time favorite. I had such a crush on him, though, when he was in Serpico and The Godfather.
Yeah.
And so he was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for only 6 minutes in a movie that's almost it's just shy of
long. Yeah,
yeah, it's just shy of 3 hours, right?
Yeah. And that's of course a good example of, like I said, a very famous star just making a cameo. And you're right, that was a good one to end, not just because it was the most recent one, which in terms of the chronology, but the fact that it was a movie about Hollywood too. It's a movie about actors, and that was, it did feel so right. And he's playing, Al Pacino plays the agent, so it all felt like this is the perfect way to end this. And I, like you, love him, and I think he is one of the greats. So again, I just wanted to start with a bang and kind of end with a bang in terms of who was in it.
Well, you certainly did that, and this is a big book. This was a labor of love. I mean,
yes,
it definitely was. I have John DeLeo, it's been great talking with you. The book is called There Are No Small Parts, 100 Outstanding Film Performances with Screen Time of 10 Minutes or Less. Now, listeners can find out much more about you and your work at johndeleo.com. Final thought you'd like to leave them with today?
Oh, goodness. I'd say if so many people say they like old movies, but I want them to seek out more than the obvious. They love Casablanca and It's a Wonderful Life and maybe Gone with the Wind and a few more, but there are hundreds of wonderful movies from the past, so maybe my books can help you find them, but there are wonderful riches out there for people who love this kind of thing, so go for it.
Yeah, and it's just great to, I think, just to see those old movies. It certainly brings back good times with my mom for me, because we'd get a box of chocolates and all settle down together and watch them, you know, on a Sunday. But job well done. There Are No Small Parts is the book again. John DeLeo, such a pleasure. Thank you for being with us. If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.